So the first one strategy for getting through these is recognition. So if desire is present, we know it's present. So this is what we've been practicing. Because this is like the first noble truth. You know, the first noble truth, the first thing the Buddha taught was, guess what? Life contains dissatisfaction, unsatisfactoriness. There's a feeling of discontent. You know, there's something here that's not just total ease. And it's prevalent, it's there, it's present, you know, when we manifest in this realm of duality. And so why is that so wonderful? I mean, so then people say, oh, Buddha is such a pessimist. God, you know, suffering, you know. Because it has been translated as life is suffering, which is completely incorrect. This is not what the Buddha said. He did not say, I mean, just hand me a gun. I mean, why are we here? It was like, we're all just stuck, you know. It's like there's elements of pain. There's elements of discontent. There's really no good translation for the word dukkha, which is what the Buddha used. It's a feeling there is dis-ease in me. And so the good news, the whole reason that the Buddha pointed this out was because he said, when we become aware of this in us, then we can transform it. And I can show you how. And so that's what this is. It's the path, you know. So first of all, we become aware. That's a really big part of it. We become aware when we feel restless, when we turn away, you know, somebody says something and we don't, you know, we just have these patterns of like this, don't like that, and want more of that, want less of that. And so we just become aware of those little impulses in us that go on. So, because they suck our energy, you know. That's what they're doing. They're constantly sucking our energy. We're trying to avoid this and get more of that. You know, we're trying basically to control life instead of being with what is, with a sense of freedom. So when we're aware of them, they become our path to awakening. So that's why we're paying attention to the pattern of our thoughts. And just like Robert said, energy flows where attention goes. So we have these basic misperceptions that we find. You know, we believe that sensual pleasures will make us happy, you know. And this leads to what's called the manifestations of the wandering mind, which is described as obsessive passion, addictive cravings, recurrent fantasies, indulging internal stories, and expecting something to happen. Seems particularly good for our culture. We're always expecting something to happen. You know, have you ever gone to a movie and it's like some movie where very little happens? It's so different from most of the movies now. So Mara, M-A-R-A, is our archetype for ignorance. Mara is the cause of all evil and suffering in the world, according to the Buddha. Mara appears as a hindrance, but in the moment of recognition, Mara loses his power. There's this story where the Buddha is, you know, it's very, the archetypal stories, just like Christ in the desert and, you know, Buddha before his awakening, Mara came to him and offered him all these kingdoms and jewels and women and, you know. And the Buddha just said, Mara, I see you, you know. And Mara lost all his power. So this recognition, this is like what we're doing here, this practice. We're recognizing when something comes up, our grasping mind, our mind of hatred or aversion or anger. This is really powerful because it just, we get all our power back. So like, just like what Lilibet was saying, it no longer becomes all of you. You can say, Mara, I see you. You're not me. It's not pushing Mara away. It's just, like Tai has this great story. He says, I just invite Mara to tea, you know. And so then he has this whole conversation between Buddha and Mara, Tai made up this story about how Mara says, oh, it's so hard being Mara, everyone hates you, and you know, all this stuff. And then the Buddha says, well, I don't know. It's not so great being the Buddha. Everybody expects you to always be this way and clear. And they're going back and forth. It's very cute. So anyway, again, you get the point. It's not to push it away. It's to recognize the impulses in you and allow them space without without cultivating unwholesome ones. So, and then the other part, of course, that we've been practicing is to know when that desire is not present, when any of the hindrances are not there. This is really powerful. Recognize, this will allow us to recognize our luminous mind. Have you ever recognized your true and luminous mind? It's really important to do. So you cultivate when your mind is free of hindrances. Or one particular hindrance, right? I'm not feeling graspy right now. Well, that's pretty great, you know. And there's always, you know, there's when you sit to meditate, you know, you might be doing a meditation on, you know, grasping is not present in me, and yet you think, oh, that's a lie. I really want to get up and go do this, you know. And so, but there's a percentage of you. There's a part of you that's happy to be there. So you hook into that part, you speak to that part. The part of me that has no desire right now, is that's the part I'm cultivating, because I need to know that there's part of me that's not completely angry, that's not restless, that's not, you know. So it's really important to cultivate both of these. And also because we tend, you know, from our evolutionary history, we tend to focus on the difficulties, you know. I mean, the danger that would come up, I mean, was much more important to be aware of than the aspects of ease, because if we weren't aware of the danger part, we'd get eaten. So we now have the luxury in this evolutionary state we're at to be able to really cultivate awareness of this wholesomeness that is in our lives and in ourselves already. To notice the elements of non-greed and non-hatred and non-delusion. So practicing with a hindrance, you can do it this way. You know how it arises. So you pick your favorite hindrance. And you become aware of what environment most causes it to arise. And then you cultivate knowing what to do. What's a method, what's a strategy to do? To work with that hindrance, to be with that hindrance. I mean, we have a general one here of meditation, but you work out your own strategy. And then you know how to keep it from arising. If it hasn't arisen, you figure out, how do I cultivate an environment and a practice so that that won't arise for me? You know, I'm just not gonna have cake in the house. You know, I mean, you know, it's like, and then you also learn to develop the opposite, you know? The opposite of grasping is generosity. So you actively cultivate that practice of generosity if you tend to have a grasping nature. That's what, you know, like the Buddha's prescription for you. And if you are in anger and aversion, you practice cultivating love. Love and compassion and empathy and kindness. And if you tend to get caught in delusion, then you cultivate clarity and wisdom. So that's kind of a general path for you to go on once you've identified what's your, you know, favorite, most predominant hindrances. So it's said that hatred is the most damaging hindrance, but it's easier to uproot because it's easy to see. You know, you can feel it. It has this real life force to it. Unless if you're walking around angry all the time, then that's different. You know, you just got a field that you need to be, like Robert was talking about, this sort of tendency, just general tendency to be reactive. That's, we all have this, you know, we come with a field of energy, and so that's really important. But if anger just tends to come up, you can see it, so it's easier to sort of let it pass. Grasping is something that's more difficult. It's less harmful, but it's more difficult to uproot because there's all these kind of shades, like, you know, so you say grasping for some sensual pleasure. Well, you know, like one scoop of strawberry ice cream, there's nothing wrong with that for a lot of people a lot of the time. But, you know, then you're like buying gallons of it at 11 o'clock at night, you know. So it's like, where is the line? So it's much more, you know, it's more difficult to uproot it because there's this no clear boundary there, you know. So that's just to let you know. Once again, I have much more than we have time for. So as we were talking about, and Robert brought up, there's sort of, we also need to learn to cultivate our background moods, you know, that sort of color our experience, our unconscious filter that we walk around with. Who said this? Somebody said this. I think Joseph Goldstein said this. We build a superstructure of self on the shifting sands of experience. So he suggests that we do, like Lilibet said, you rather than claiming, oh, I am angry, you just cultivate that, you realize there's anger, and you go, oh, angry mind is like this. You know, happy mind is like this. Again, using those observational skills. And this gives us a taste of freedom. So the mind, you know, is already free and peaceful. The hindrances are just visitors. So gladness or sadness is not the mind, it's only a trick. No. The mind is already free and peaceful, so what we're doing here is we're taking good care of our minds. Alan Wallace says, the mind can unravel its own twists, tangles, and distortions by mindfully resting in its natural state. So that's what we're doing when we're sitting and just resting, allowing that rest to be. It's like we're untangling, you know. You see this, I'm a knitter, and you see the yarn that's like all tangled up. And, you know, you can't really do much. It's like what we're just, you have to be really gentle. You know, you can't pull on it or it just gets tighter and tighter. That's what we're doing when we're sitting, just allowing the mind to untangle. And he says it's both diagnostic, like in this same metaphor of the Buddha as a physician, it's both diagnostic and therapeutic. So it's diagnostic because we watch the mental layers, you know. We just watch, like just like Gary was describing, we watch what feels like this, and then underneath that is that, and underneath that. And so it's this untangling, unraveling of these knots or fetters. We heal by just watching the mind come into balance through shining the light of awareness on whatever arises. And it's therapeutic because it's healing. Just that practice, just that process of observation is healing, letting it be. So I have a whole part on a book I called, I read recently that I really like, called The Power of Habit. And it's about changing our habits. I wonder if I could say this really quickly. He gives a whole strategy, sort of like a whole prescription for how to change a habit. Basically, it's a, there's a cue. C-U-E, a cue for behavior, then there's a routine that happens, and then there's a reward, you know. Want cake, go to refrigerator, you know, eat cake, you know, kind of thing. And so, you know, basically he says that there's the same cue and the same reward, that, well, not eat cake isn't the reward, but feeling what, you know, the after you eat the cake, whatever. But the routine is changed, so you change the process. Anyway, this is really, it's all about neuroscience and how it's changed the pathways, and maybe I'll have time to talk about it a little bit more next time. But he was very interesting because he talked about this formula for changing habits, but then at the end, he said there's one more element, there's a fourth element that's essential for changing, and that's belief. Belief that you can change. And he said it's almost impossible to get that belief if you're not in a group, which I thought was really remarkable. He said, because other people, did I tell you this last time? Yeah, that other people reflect that back to you, that you can do it. And they give you that support, they're model for you, and they also give you that confidence. And so that's what we're doing here, is really creating the sangha of belief. So one more thing, and then we'll do a final meditation. I'm going to come back over and over again to the study and the practice and the understanding of non-self, because this is really running through all of our practice here. When we watch our mind, the thoughts and feelings in our minds and bodies come and go, you know, we realize that, well, I guess I wasn't that feeling, you know, even though it seemed very overwhelming. Now it's an hour later and I don't feel that way at all. I can hardly even remember that feeling, or I can sometimes remember the feeling, but I don't remember what caused it, you know. And so we're really addressing this idea of non-self. Alan Wallace said, if there is no inherently existing self, there is no owner of free will and no supernatural agent calling the shots. In Buddhist practice, we simply attend to what arises without imputing agency or ownership. So that may or may not be your belief system. It doesn't matter. You can have whatever belief system you want. But right now, in this practice, what we're doing is just attending to what arises. And I have one story to share with you about, this happened to us, it was the end of August. And we had tickets to this Brit concert, and actually it was the next day was our anniversary, and so it was kind of an anniversary thing. And it was a beautiful night, and we were really looking forward to hearing this musician. And I was getting ready, and I was just about ready to go, and we got this phone call at 4:45 that said, the concert is canceled. The artist is sick. And so this is what happened. This was so amazing because the next day, it wasn't until the next day when somebody said, oh, the concert was canceled, that I realized what happened to me. I was standing there all dressed and ready to go, and I didn't have any thoughts about whether it was a good or not good thing. It was just like, oh, well, we're going out to dinner, we'll just go, and you know. And then I realized that in my mind, 99.9% of the time, I run through the story would be first like one side of the sheet. Oh, bummer. Really wanted to see her. Anniversary. Nice to be outdoors with friends, you know. And then, oh, we don't have to drive all that way. What a relief. I won't be tired the next day because, you know. And then I decide whether I'm happy or bummed about it. I'm that pearl view. I'm in charge deciding. That'll happen instantaneously. And it's like, that didn't happen. And I was like, oh, this stuff works, you know. And I mean, like I'm saying, 99.9% of the time, it's still happening. But that one time, it forgot to operate. It was like, I was free. So I'm just saying it's really important to share these stories, these moments of glory, so that we know this happened. So let's have one more quick, short meditation. We'll go into this more next time because there's really not time to talk about it. But perhaps you might want to experiment with, for those of us who are used to meditating with our eyes closed, you might want to experiment meditating with your eyes open. A long time meditator that I am, with my eyes closed, it's really not easy to do this. But what I found is one of the values of it is that when I really believe that my mind is in here. So I close my eyes to get in touch with my mind, to get in touch with myself. But in fact, that's not really true. I'm not just in this body. So it may be uncomfortable and you may not want to do it regularly, but you might want to just try it. And just with an empty, you know, just empty gaze, not focused on anything. So we settle. And once again, just allow your attention to rest on the flow of thoughts, images, and memories that arise without being pulled toward them or away from them. And as you notice them arising, you might feel ownership towards some of them. And other thoughts and feelings might seem to arise almost independently of you, that you're merely a witness. So investigate closely what makes some mental events seem to be yours, while others just simply occur. And as you continue this practice, just examine the level of ownership you attribute to each thought and feeling. Just beliefs of I or mine. So these practices obviously are just a little taste, but that's a really good one to do at home. When you start observing and watching the flow of mental activity, observe how attached you are, which ones you believe are you and which ones you believe are just, you know, miscellaneous. So I just want to end with a quote from teacher Sylvia Boorstein. She describes mindfulness this way. What the Buddha promised is that human beings like himself and like us can change the habits of our mind by paying attention to these habits. And not just change our thoughts and views, we can actually change the way we process our thoughts and our views. We can become free of identities that are constricting and views that hold happiness hostage. We can be authentically and kindly wise. So next week we're going to have a love fest, doing love meditation. This is really going to be wonderful. So your assignment is to do the next chapter, called Love Meditation, on metta, loving kindness practice, and the four immeasurable minds. And this is going to be wonderful.